This is a true crime in real time update from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast.
The courtroom was still as Lori Vallow Daybell stood before Judge Justin Bareski, the weight of her words thick in the air. For the past 5 years that I have been incarcerated, she said, her voice steady, almost defiant, I have taken it upon myself to study case law and criminal rules of procedure. And with that, one of the most polarizing figures in recent criminal history sealed her intent to represent herself in two Arizona murder trials. The judge's decision to grant her request was met with both curiosity and disbelief, a move that underscored the ever-present complexity of Daybell's tangled legal saga. Daybell's decision was not one made lightly. Over a concise 15-minute hearing, Judge Bareski probed her understanding of the legal system, her education level, and her ability to handle what he called potentially complicated cases with lots of evidence. To each question, she responded confidently. A high school graduate with no formal legal training, Daybell nevertheless claimed to have a decade of procedural study under her belt, including participation in 3 full trials. Though these were not as an attorney, but rather as a party. Her audacity was striking, her self-assurance unnerving. The room hung on her every word. For most, self-representation in criminal trials is akin to stepping into the lion's den without a shield. But Daybell insisted she was very prepared. Whether that was sheer bravado or a calculated strategy remains to be seen. What is clear, however, is the enormity of the task before her. Conspiracy charges in connection to the murders of her fourth husband, Charles Vallow, and her former nephew-in-law, Brandon Boudreau, will be tried separately, beginning with the Vallow case on March 31st. Should she falter, her advisory attorneys, Pamela Hicks and Robert Abernethy, will step in, but only if she disrupts proceedings, fails to show up, or changes her mind about representing herself. The stakes couldn't be higher. This move follows Daybell's life sentence in Idaho for the murders of her children, Joshua, J.J., Vallow, and Tylee Ryan, as well as Tammy Daybell, her husband Chad Daybell's previous wife. That trial ended with her conviction and no possibility of parole, ensuring she will spend the rest of her life behind bars. Yet, here she stands, steadfast in her belief that she can outmaneuver an Arizona prosecution team with vast resources and no shortage of evidence. The decision to allow Daybell to self-represent isn't without precedent, but it's rare. Judge Bareski reminded her of the complexities of courtroom procedure and the risks of acting as her own attorney. Still, Daybell brushed aside the warnings, her resolve undaunted. She'll prepare motions, deliver her opening statement, cross-examine witnesses, and could even take the stand, though any testimony must be facilitated through her advisory attorneys should she choose that route. It's a high-wire act with no safety net, and the legal world is watching. Behind her calculated calm, the implications of her self-representation loom large. What does this say about her psyche, her motivations? Is it narcissism, desperation, or something more sinister? The psychological undercurrents of her decision can't be ignored. Representing oneself in a case of this magnitude demands not only legal acumen, but also an almost superhuman ability to detach from the emotional weight of the charges, a feat Daybell seems unbothered by. Her upcoming trials promise to be as dramatic as her life story. With Charles Vallow's murder trial just months away and Brandon Boudreau's to follow, Daybell's courtroom theatrics could dominate headlines once again. Will this gamble work in her favor? Or is it a last-ditch effort to control a narrative that has long slipped from her grasp? For now, the world waits as Daybell prepares for the fight of her life, with only her voice and a legal system she claims to know intimately as her weapons. Lori Vallow, Daybell's choice to represent herself in 2 high-stakes murder trials is a move that has rarely succeeded in history, particularly for defendants whose arrogance and overconfidence outpace their legal knowledge. The courtroom has long been a stage where narcissistic tendencies collide with cold, hard evidence, often to disastrous results. Daybell's decision evokes a chilling lineage of defendants who believed they could outsmart the justice system only to crumble under the weight of their own hubris. Take Ted Bundy, for instance. The infamous serial killer was no stranger to the spotlight and relished his time in court. Bundy's charm and intelligence were undeniable, and he fully believed he could use those traits to manipulate jurors and outmaneuver seasoned prosecutors. Representing himself, Bundy turned the trial into a theatrical performance, using every opportunity to grandstand and control the narrative. But while he fixated on impressing the gallery, the prosecution meticulously dismantled his defense. The evidence was overwhelming, his theatrics were transparent, and his belief in his own brilliance ultimately led to his conviction and a death sentence. Bundy's story is a testament to how self-representation often exposes more about a defendant's psyche than their innocence. Colin Ferguson, the Long Island Railroad shooter, offers another cautionary tale. Ferguson's decision to represent himself resulted in one of the most surreal trials in recent memory. He cross-examined the very victims who survived his attack, forcing them to relive the horror while he insisted on his innocence. The proceedings became a disturbing spectacle of denial and delusion, with Ferguson's lack of legal expertise painfully evident at every turn. The outcome was inevitable, a swift conviction and multiple life sentences. His case demonstrated how self-representation not only fails to shield a defendant, but can also amplify their guilt in the eyes of the jury. Then there's Mark Hoffman, the notorious forger and murderer. Hoffman's confidence in his abilities knew no bounds, both in his forgeries and in his attempts to control the legal narrative. However, his courtroom strategy unraveled as his lies and forgeries were systematically exposed. Hoffman's overconfidence, much like Bundy's and Ferguson's, became his downfall, a reminder that even the cleverest schemes falter when faced with diligent prosecution. Jody Arias presents a more recent example of courtroom control gone awry. While she didn't fully represent herself, Arias constantly clashed with her defense team and manipulated the trial's narrative whenever possible. Her attempts to outsmart the prosecution and paint herself as a victim only highlighted her manipulative tendencies. The jury saw through her performance, and her efforts to control the narrative ultimately led to her conviction for the brutal murder of Travis Alexander. Her case is a reminder that even partial attempts at self-representation can backfire when the truth becomes too evident to ignore. And finally, there's Dylan Roof, whose decision to represent himself during the sentencing phase of his trial was a chilling display of hubris and detachment. Roof showed no remorse and refused to mount any meaningful defense, believing that his actions would speak for themselves. Instead, his cold, emotionless demeanor only solidified the jury's resolve, and they swiftly sentenced him to death. Roof's case underscores how self-representation, particularly in high-profile trials, can magnify a defendant's moral and strategic failures. What ties these cases together is a fatal overconfidence, a belief that the courtroom is not a place for justice, but a stage to display their perceived superiority. In each instance, self-representation became the ultimate miscalculation, revealing the defendant's flaws, lies, and arrogance to an audience that included their judge, jury, and victims. Lori Vallow Daybell's decision to represent herself places her squarely in this troubling tradition. With the evidence against her mounting and the complexity of the charges apparent, her choice to go it alone raises serious questions about her motivations and strategy. Is this a calculated move to control the narrative, a reflection of her belief in her own invincibility, or simply another act of defiance against a system she believes she can outmaneuver? Whatever the answer, history suggests that the odds are not in her favor. As her trials approach, Daybell's gamble looms large. Will she become an outlier who defies the odds, or will her self-representation end in the same way as Bundy, Ferguson, Hoffman, Arias, and Roof, ensnared by her own arrogance, convicted not just by evidence, but by her own performance in court? For now, all we can do is wait and watch as another chapter in her deeply unsettling saga unfolds.
In a world where the darkest secrets lie just beneath the surface.
They said it was an accident, but the evidence says otherwise.
Where hidden killers roam unnoticed. in the shadows.
I think you would definitely be looking at a blend of toxic, very bad narcissistic personality traits, and they will be vengeful and possibly resort to violence.
Join Tony Bruschi as he uncovers the truth behind the most chilling cases.
They said it was an accident, but the evidence clearly says otherwise.
Each episode, we dig deep into the minds of those who commit the unthinkable.
To your point on narcissism, he thinks in his own mind how witty he is.
Yeah.
But he lost that jury. I was done with him in 2 minutes.
From unsolved mysteries to infamous crimes.
Geez, you've just talked about how you've taught yourself how to do everything under the sun. I bet you did a YouTube video, how to best kill somebody with a knife.
Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi takes you where few dare to go.
How does someone with such a dark secret go unnoticed for so long?
With multiple new episodes every single day.
We're not just telling stories, we're seeking justice.
Listen now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.